going on, everybody? Alan Kenny, managing editor with CrystalBallRun.com, the blog your network's national college football blog. And we're so close to the season, I wanted to bring in one of my favorite guests. He writes for the CollegeFootballNews.com, Matt Zemek. He is easily one of my favorite writers out there. We're going to talk about a few big picture kind of questions that we're going to be watching, stuff to watch this season. So without further ado, Matt, what's going on, man?
A lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's T minus 2 weeks now, thankfully.
Yeah, yeah, so close, you know, and there's just tons of news coming out from all over the place. This is going to be a Johnny Manziel-free podcast. You have my word on that, folks. I'm sure that Matt has had plenty of his fill talking about Texas A&M's embattled quarterback himself. But what we're going to do here is we're going to talk about, you know, we're each going to give kind of three storylines or themes that we're going to be watching this season and what we're going to be paying real close attention to as the season kicks off here in a couple weeks. So why don't we go ahead? I'm going to go ahead and let Matt kick it off. So, Matt, what's your first thing to watch that you think fans should keep an eye on?
Well, a mandatory – I mean, I don't cover games on site. I just cover them from home and, you know, watching, you know, the bank O monitors, as it were. Mm-hmm. But a mandatory week one question in locker rooms and in press conferences to coaches, at least, is going to be, Coach, how did the new targeting rules affect this game and the way your players played it? That's going to be such a hugely significant thing to monitor over the course of the season. And in particular, there are two reasons this is true, Alan. One is obviously the potential consequences. You know, think of Jadeveon Clowney getting ejected, you know, in the second quarter against Georgia and the impact that a scenario like that mm-hmm. could have, not just on a game, but on the whole SEC season and tangentially, possibly, you know, the national title race. The other thing, though, is that, you know, there are, with points of emphasis in officiating, and this is not limited to football, it applies to any sport. With points of emphasis, you have human beings thrust into a context defined at least partly, if not totally, by interpretation. I mean, every human being is going to take a given point of emphasis a little bit differently. Might be some general consistency, but in this situation here or that situation there, there could be just a slight difference in interpretation, and that difference could mean so much. One of the things, Alan, that I imagine you've been able to keep track with over the years in terms of my work is that I'm always, during the season, when it starts, and it's going to happen, you know, in 2 weeks from now, is I'm going to rail on and on and on about how officiating, ever since the Jabbar Gaffney touchdown catch against Tennessee in the year 2000, officiating has steadily moved toward the direction of giving less of a benefit of the doubt to receivers on borderline completed or incomplete passes. You see more rulings that go toward in the direction of incomplete passes. And that is, in some ways, a product of the written rule and the emphasis on completing a football move. But it's also just it's a part of the mindset of officiating. And there was definitely a change in mindset when that Jabbar Gaffney catch occurred. And you could feel it permeate through the officiating profession that, you know, it was felt, you know, that really didn't look like a catch. It didn't really feel like a catch. So in the future, let's make sure that kind of play isn't ruled a catch as much. I mean, this isn't a 2+2=4 thing, but it really was a shift in emphasis and interpretation. And so with that kind of 12-year history, now about to be 13-year history in mind, I'm very mindful of how interpretation and this benefit of the doubt and this instinctive approach is going to affect the targeting rules and the many consequences that are wrapped up in it.
Yeah, and the thing about it is with the targeting rules, of course, I mean, this is not a matter of you know, just a 15-yard penalty. I mean, you're talking about ejections, which can have pretty significant impacts on the game. You know, it's funny you mentioned, you know, the issues with now with determining what's a catch and what's not. I know that our good friend Michael Felder rails on and on about how defensive backs have lost the benefit of the doubt on pass interference too. So, yeah, I mean, you're right though. There are these moments where it just feels like so much, you know, the tuck rule, for example, in the NFL, which, you know, of course now is no more, but, you know, I mean, that was one too. I wonder though, you know, you follow officiating so closely and you do, you're quite the watchdog when it comes to that. But, you know, one area where we probably differ is, I think that a lot of the inconsistencies and issues actually come up because of replay and the idea that you've got you know, someone kind of looking over your shoulder to make those calls.
You know, Alan, I think there's a lot to that. My counter, or it's not even really a counter. My response is that so if officials you know, are tentative and they're reticent to make certain kinds of calls on the field, I just think that there should be more expansive replay authority to be able to overturn or reverse those calls. That we have the technological mechanisms with which to get a lot of calls right. And one of the things I think is that pass interference should be a reviewable call, given its constancy in the sport and given the impact that pass interference calls have on games. So I think that you're right in that officials are going to make a lot of mistakes on the field because they know that, you know, there's this lurking presence over their shoulder. I just think that issue can be solved by having more use of replay to correct any on-field mistakes that officials make. And one thing I said in my final weekly affirmation last year after this regular season was over in mid-December, we as football fans should not be nearly as angry at officials as we are. I mean, when I say we as a sporting culture, not necessarily writers, but writers, fans, players, coaches, everybody, we should not be nearly as angry at officials as they are, because this is an incredibly difficult job. The sport moves faster than ever before. It's more violent than ever before. It's really a thankless job that the officials have. We should be grateful for the service that they render. The key thing is that fans get angry at officials to the extent that they do, precisely because there's the awareness that there is not enough replay use to overturn mistakes. If there was more of an ability, if there was a more expansive power for replay to redress grievances and to correct mistakes, fans wouldn't get upset at the initial calls because they would know that there was a corrective mechanism in place. And that is the thing that a lot of people who say that replay should be limited, you know, I don't want a four-and-a-half-hour game, that's the thing that the critics of replay and its use really miss in this larger argument about college football officiating.
Yeah, see, I'm in the I'd rather just get rid of replay altogether and just have everybody suck it up. But, you know, I mean, you're right in the sense that, you know, the world does evolve and technology does improve. So I guess yeah, I'm not going to concede this point to you, Matt, but I definitely understand where we're coming from. So,
well, you know what? All I can say, Alan, is that you must have loved the 1979 Rose Bowl between USC and Michigan.
You know, another game that I loved where officiating and replay had an impact or lack thereof on the end, that was Oklahoma-Oregon 2006, of course. Didn't go the right way for the good guys there. Back then, Oregon had a quarterback by the name of Dennis Dixon, who was quite something to watch back there, running their early kind of version of the spread. You know, they've had a few guys come through there, of course, under Chip Kelly's system, the blur there, Jeremiah Masoli, Darren Thomas. But one of the big questions that I'm watching this season, my first one is going to be the new guy they've got there under center at for the Ducks. That's Marcus Mariota. If it wasn't for Johnny Manziel last year, Mariota would have been a huge story. He had an absolutely monstrous season. He's clearly, in my opinion, of the quarterbacks that they've had there, he's the best. He's the most in command. He's the smoothest. I think that this year you're going to see Mariota really blossom, and I suspect at the end of the season, he's going to be taking home the Heisman Trophy. He'd be my bet, at least, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him come April standing up there as a very, very high pick in the upcoming NFL draft.
I would say that he's a very likely bet to be a finalist and get a plane ticket to New York. I think the biggest thing with respect to Mariota is that, you know, he experienced firsthand. He was in the arena when Stanford, and particularly Stanford's defense, registered one of the most amazing single-game accomplishments I've seen in a long time in college football, and that is to hold Oregon to 14 points in an overtime game in Autzen Stadium. And I think that Mariota is going to look at that game. He's going to absorb all the lessons that Stanford taught him in that game, and he's going to unfurl a masterpiece against the Cardinal on that Thursday night. Later this season when the Ducks and Cardinal meet. And a big performance in that game coupled with, you know, generally above-average performances the rest of the way, yeah, that should get him a plane ticket to New York.
Yeah, you know, the big question is what kind of, chemistry and relationship he's able to develop with not only, I mean, he's got, you know, got that with the guys around him, but, you know, watching how Mark Helfrich kind of pilots this team from the sidelines is going to be very interesting to me. But it's definitely a big plus for Helfrich that he has such a polished quarterback back there.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's not as though Oregon is going to have to score, you know, 42, 49 points against Stanford. That probably would be more than enough. It's just a matter of, you know, learning how to handle certain situations, knowing what to do when, you know, your offensive line is getting pushed around, isn't perhaps playing as well as it can play, making adjustments to various situations, and knowing how to be more of a leader on the field and to handle more of the intangibles, which, you know, he quite didn't fully have the hang of last year. Those kinds of things are really going to come into play a lot for him.
Yeah, should be an exciting year up there in Eugene. So, give me what's your second thing to watch this year?
Well, you know, I'm really fascinated with the coaching situations at both USC and Texas. But just to choose one, since I'm out here in Seattle, you know, USC is the obvious point of fascination. You know, Pat Hayden in public has been very resolute in his support of Lane Kiffin. But I have to wonder that if USC loses five regular season games again this season, you know, boosters and alumni, they're going to make their voices heard, and you're going to have 35,000-40,000 empty seats at the Coliseum. And I really have a hard time thinking that Lane Kiffin can survive a regular season that's anything close to what happened in 2012. But yet Hayden, you know, there seems to be this icy cool veneer about him. And, you know, is he really going to stick by Kiffin through thick and thin this season? It's going to be one of the more fascinating dramas of the season if indeed USC struggles. And I do think USC will, because I think that you know, when Kiffin maxed out in 2011 and did an admittedly great job, you know, USC registered that accomplishment without the pressure of having to play for a national championship and for a Pac-12 title. So as soon as national championship and conference prizes came back into play in 2012, the fact that USC so completely crumbled in the face of that real-world game pressure, you know, that showed me that, you know, Lane Kiffin really had not turned the corner as a coach. So I find it, I am, consider me a skeptic, basically, in terms of Lane Kiffin's ability to rally the troops and to put the pieces back together in Los Angeles this season.
Yeah, you know, Kiffin's a hard case for me because I don't know. I look at him and it feels like he has just such an abundance of resources there at USC. So much talent, but you know they've been in that sense, I think that they've really been kind of underachieving, of course. But I mean, those sanctions that they got hit with in the wake of the Reggie Bush scandal and whatnot, and then you know, going from there, it just feels to me like it's really hard to put that much blame on him, given how thin they are from a depth standpoint.
That's true, and what I will acknowledge, Alan, is that you know I was a much more vicious critic of Kiffin in the past, especially at Tennessee in 2009. But you know there are people who, plenty of people, USC fans in particular, who think that you know it should not have been a close call, that Kiffin definitely should have been fired after last season, and that's a point on which I will strongly disagree with USC fans and anyone who thought that Kiffin should be fired. I think you'd readily agree with me, Alan, that if you're going to hire a coach, and this is even more so if you're at a high-profile or established program, you want to really know fully that a coach has been given every chance to either succeed or fail, and that you've seen a coach in a full swath of situations, that you've seen him in so many different contexts that you can truly make a full, well-rounded evaluation of who and what he is as a coach. And it's precisely for those reasons that you just mentioned about the severe NCAA penalties and all the turmoil and tumult and the lack of depth on the roster. It's for those reasons that we still don't fully know whether Lane Kiffin, you know, toss out the experiences with the Raiders and with Tennessee, we still don't really know if Kiffin has been given every chance to succeed or fail at USC. And, you know, and if he does turn things around this season, well, you know, then the notion of firing him after 2012 will have been quite clearly premature.
Yeah, I'm betting that that he gets another year after this, but we'll see. All right, my second one, big question this year. It's pretty amazing when you look back at the defense that Texas fielded in 2011, which was easily one of the best in the country, versus what the Longhorns got last year, which was just a mess. I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering which defense Texas will get this year. I mean, you know, you're starting to hear the rumblings that, you know, this should be a team that, you know, is certainly in contention for the Big 12 title and a potential national championship game participant. I mean, it's Texas. They've got all the resources. They've got all the talent that that you could really ask for. But you know, and they're especially with a somewhat of a transition that they're making on offense to a more up tempo, no huddle, almost Oregon like offense. I think that how the defense performs this year for them is going to be a really, really big big factor in just how far they can go, and really in Mac Brown, you know, sticking around for a few more years there on the 40 acres.
Well, the basic thing that strikes me, Alan, about Texas's defense is that it's not as though the defense was horrible in 2012 for overly complicated reasons. I mean, they just couldn't tackle. Mm-hmm. And they just got physically dominated, and you know, especially by an Oklahoma offense that, you know, as was seen against Notre Dame and some other physical teams, you know, got bossed around. But against Texas, Oklahoma was able to just, you know, roll up its sleeves and use its muscle to obliterate Texas. So it's what's discouraging for Texas is that its defense got beaten in such a simple, fundamental way. And so when you face that kind of deficiency and you stare down that kind of humiliation, it suggests that the road to, you know, renewal and toward to you know, reclaiming a true Texas identity, that road's going to be a very long one. So it's hard to maintain too much optimism with respect to Texas's defense, but the one salvation is that this year's Big 12, it could be very, very forgiving and very, very conquerable, even for this Texas team.
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting question. I mean, for example, let's say Texas wins the Big 12 at 10-2, for example. Is that enough to kind of keep the Wolves at bay with Mack Brown? It's going to be a very interesting season there in Austin. What's your final thing to watch this year?
You know, it's something that I never would have thought would be one of my top three things to watch before college football season in a million years. Never thought it would happen, but hey, we live in strange times, do we not? Mm. And here's a disclaimer. I am not enraptured by the Heisman Trophy. I am not captured or captivated by the award. I was as a kid, but you know, since covering college football for College Football News, I have really come to be very disillusioned by the whole sausage-making process of the Heisman Trophy Award and who decides on the finalists and the winners and
you
so
said,
on
wait,
and so
is,
forth.
Are you talking about the Heisman or the BCS, Matt?
Well, they're both beauty pageants in a way, yeah. But, you know, there's such a romance surrounding the Heisman for a lot of people, and it has interestingly resurfaced in the wake of this of the summer of Manziel, because a lot of people, it's more than just a tiny minority, it's a sizable minority, if not perhaps a small plurality of people in the country think that, you know, a Heisman Trophy winner is supposed to carry himself at a higher level, is supposed to display superior moral and ethical conduct than other people, and that the Heisman Trophy Award is rooted in integrity. People have that impression, and a lot of the criticism of Manziel has stemmed from this notion that, well, he is kind of an exalted public figure now as a result of winning the Heisman Trophy. And it's something that I really had not seen or felt or appreciated the previous few years. And one of the things that I noticed, and I wrote about it and I tweeted about it last year, was how Colin Klein in flyover country at Kansas State, with personal views on morality that are not too different from Tim Tebow, very, very old-fashioned sense of values, very traditionalist kind of moral compass, but he didn't get a fraction of the publicity that Tim Tebow received. And so it last year showed me, and I know plenty of people will disagree with me, but to me, it last year showed that if you're in the SEC as opposed to the Big 12, and if you're at a sexier program compared to a less sexy program, you know, that's going to influence the way the Heisman Trophy voting shakes down. It's going to influence media coverage. It's going to influence the amount of minutes you're on TV and the internet each day, each week. And those factors go into who wins the award. So now, in light of the summer of Manziel, if we're going to view Heisman Trophy winners as kind of public figures with greater moral and ethical responsibility, boy, you know, how is this going to shape the 2013 Heisman Trophy race? And are we going to have arguments now about the morality and ethics of the foremost competitors in late November? I am repulsed by this, Alan. And yet, as is the case with so many aspects of national and international politics, that which is repulsive can also be pretty doggone fascinating. So I'm going to be riveted, even though I'm going to be disgusted at the same time.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I know that with Cam Newton, I mean, there were certainly some voters who specifically, declined to vote for Cam, you know, given what happened with his father and the allegations against them. This with Manziel, well, now, of course, he's under an NCAA investigation, so that kind of changes that angle, too. But, you know, even before this, you know, there was this kind of idea that I didn't, this impulse that, you know, I didn't quite agree with, that somehow his, I guess, you know, carousing, so to speak, in the off season showed that he, you know, either didn't deserve to win the award last year, or definitely shouldn't garner consideration for it going forward. And it, you're right; it really doesn't. It doesn't make that much sense to me. So I'm totally with you in that. I'm going to be interested to see how it goes this year. And you know, there's so many. I mean, you think about it. You had Manziel last year, and then you had Manti Te'o also, who, you know, the media pushed this narrative about him and his, you know, all the kind of tragedy that he was struggling through at the time last season, which of course all turned out to be you know, complete. Well, I mean, his grandmother was not, but of course, his losing his girlfriend turned out to be a complete fabrication. You know, the whole thing, these secondary stories, these, you know, off the field, I just wish they'd just give it up, you know? I mean, it's like they just need this filler for, I don't know, College game day or something on Saturday mornings, and it impacts so much more than it really should.
Yep, and it's the TMZization of College game day, too.
My last one is Bo Pelini in Nebraska. I've made my admiration for the Nebraska program well known throughout the years. You know, I mean, growing up, the Nebraska-Oklahoma rivalry was everything. And of course, you know, with the way that everything shook out during conference realignment and whatnot, that, you know, kind of took on less and less significance. But I always remember Nebraska as, you know, a fan base that is as nice and as humble and classy, and I hate the word classy, but as you'll find anywhere. And I, you know, it was always a rivalry between Oklahoma and Nebraska that had a lot of mutual admiration, I think. And so, you know, I it's a program that I always am going to be rooting for to kind of you know, pull itself up, and you know, knowing especially what the program means to that state and whatnot. And you know, it just feels like with Bo Pelini, I don't know. It doesn't feel to me like it's necessarily a, you know, just a perfect match. And, you know, his name comes up a lot in the off season for other jobs. It makes you wonder if he's not happy there. And the program in and of itself has, it's not, it's, I guess you could say it's kind of been steadily eroding really since Tom Osborne left. And it's kind of in this lull, this no man's land right now. And of course, you know, I mean, there were games last year like that Big Ten championship game where the Cornhuskers got run over by Wisconsin. It just makes you wonder what the psyche and mood of the program is right now. So I'm kind of watching that because it just seems like there's some disharmony there to me.
Yeah, this is. You know, I mean, the word bizarre can be used in many ways, and frequently the word bizarre applies to, you know, behavior. Well, so, you know, the word bizarre does not need to be and shouldn't be applied in its kind of darker or more twisted sense to Nebraska football. I'm certainly not intending to do that. But just in terms of the personality of the program, the style of ball that the Huskers play these days, and the way that the past three, four seasons have evolved under Pelini, bizarre really is a word that fits. I mean, think about it. In 2009, Nebraska looked and felt like Nebraska. Mm-hmm. I mean, the offense was painfully bad, but the team was based on rugged physical defense. I mean, in 2009, Nebraska football was smash mouth football. It was power football. It was the old school identity and vision. Perhaps not elegantly executed, you know, the way the Turner Gill offenses were in the early 80s or the way the Tommy Frazier offenses were in the 1990s. Certainly not that, but rugged physical football with defense being the cornerstone. That was very much in evidence in 2009. And then you had Taylor Martinez, you know, being so erratic in the early stages of his career, and it looked as though things were actually going to be, you know, Nebraska's fortunes were going to plummet. But then the last few years, you've just seen this weird inversion of the Nebraska identity. You're seeing the Huskers put up a lot of points in the passing game with Martinez, whom I really criticized a lot in 2011. You know, stepping up his game in 2012, still, you know, some ragged edges, but a lot of production with his defense hanging him out to dry. And so it's kind of like you have the worst of the Bill Callahan era, but you also have some of the more redeeming features of the Bill Callahan era, and you have them under Bo Pelini, you know, who used to, you know, be at LSU and Oklahoma. It is just so thoroughly bizarre from beginning to end, forwards, backwards. It really leaves you speechless at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's definitely a program that I'm hoping, you know, puts it together and everything. And if you know, that comes after Pelini leaves or what have you, or, you know, then that's fine with them. But I'm always going to be rooting for Nebraska. So, well, that kind of covers everything that I was hoping to get through, you know. Matt, okay, tell you what. Let me ask you this. Looking ahead, let's see here. Looking ahead at this season, is there one game, you know, that you're really looking forward to watching or that's really piquing your interest?
Well, you know, obviously people will focus on Alabama, Texas A&M, but I think that there's going to be such a revenge factor in play for the Tide that game is probably going to be a blowout in favor of Alabama. And I think that Manziel is going to be swimming in so much controversy that it's going to be hard for him to play with great clarity and conviction in that game. So the contest I'm looking forward to is South Carolina and Georgia a week earlier. South Carolina has had great success against Georgia, and yet there's this curious fact that, you know, South Carolina, despite beating Georgia the last couple seasons, has not won the SEC East. So with those subplots kind of forming a part of the backdrop, how will each team respond to this early week two pressure cooker when you have huge conference games, you know, before we actually get to technically autumn? It's always one of the great pieces of theater in the college football season. So that's certainly a game that I'm going to be paying attention to early on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the one game that I'm really looking forward to watching this year, I thought that, we touched on it earlier. I thought that last year that Stanford Oregon game was just, it was so bizarre to watch Oregon get stymied that way by Stanford. And Stanford's such a well-coached team, so physical, and Oregon is, you know, high-flying. That's the game that I'm going to be looking forward to probably the most this year. It seems like that's been the most fun the past few years to watch, and intriguing, specifically, especially from a strategic standpoint. So anyway, well, hey, Matt, you know, it's always a pleasure talking with you, man. Do you guys have anything big going on with college football news heading into the season?
Well, there are a couple things going on, and I'll just briefly mention two. One of them is that starting tomorrow, we debuted an item in 2012 called By the Numbers, looking at seasons numerically. And so we compiled a version of 2012 By the Numbers, but we dug into the archives and tried to look at as many box scores as possible. Didn't find them all, but we found, you know, like 98% of them. And so starting tomorrow, we're going to unveil By the Numbers for 2003 through 2011, and then we'll reprint the 2012 edition on Wednesday, August 28th, the day before the season starts. And then our staple column at College Football News, my staple column at College Football News, the weekly affirmation, I'm going to come out with a first edition for the season on Monday, August 26th, and I'm going to have a guest essayist, Tim Hyland, with Twitter handle IntelligentCFB, provide a few guest weekly affirmations throughout the season, and he's going to have one ready for opening day on Thursday, August 29th. So the weekly affirmation with two return editions the last week of August as the season kicks off.
Awesome. Yeah, Tim is a really, really sharp guy. I really enjoy his work. So that's great to hear that you guys have he's going to be contributing with you guys. So anyway, well, Matt, I've taken up a lot of your time here. I'm so appreciative, though, that you came on to talk tonight about what we're looking forward to watching this year in college football.
I always have a blast, Alan, and I'm sure we'll talk more as the season approaches.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thank you all for joining us, too. For CrystalBallRun.com, I'm Alan Kenny. Take it easy.